Welcome to the Multifamily Deal Lab Podcast, where we dissect a deal before your eyes and ears so you can discover the strategies and tactics that got each deal to the finish line. Strategies and tactics that you can put in your own toolbox to get you to the closing table. From sourcing the deal, raising, due diligence to the property takeover, Multifamily Deal Lab shows how you too can get the deal done. And now here's your host, David Lindahl.
Welcome everybody to the Multifamily Deal Lab. I'm Dave Lindahl. My guest today is Jimmy Stewart. We're going to analyze a couple of his deals and we'll take you forward on that. I got some updates on what's going on with rents in a second, but let's finish the conversation about your workout. What are you doing for workout?
Yeah, so I work out every second day with the weights, and then every day I'm doing 45 minutes of cardio, and I'm talking not just cardio, I'm talking intense, being in the target high heart rate zone. And it's taken me a while to get there, but I live for that now. I get the endorphins out of it. I've been blessed. For instance, the last couple of days, the weather's been gorgeous, so my daughters wanted to go for bike rides. So you go out for a nice bike ride with her, and it's just been really good family time. We're very fortunate, very spacious home, so we've got lots of space, and it's been good. But yeah, the workouts, I have a full-blown gym in the house, so even though I did work out I've got my own program. Yeah, oh. I'm not doing any sort of specific one. I've just got my own routines and whatnot. Of course, we talked about at the mastermind, I mentioned Dr. Jeffrey Leif, I'm working with, and he's a great resource in terms of executive health management, being proactive as opposed to reactive. So he's doing a great job for me.
You know who was on last week was Vic and Ravi.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, so they were talking about Beachbody. Yep. And we were talking about Beachbody and their programs, and he turned me on to a program called The Work, and it's really good.
Is it? Yeah?
Yeah, if you want something, for $99, you get all their programs for the entire year. Yeah, and I've been a member for, 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. I've done P90X like 14 times.
Right.
But the work, that makes you work. It's really good. Yeah. It's been great.
Yeah. I've done that.
Your heart rate up to a certain point, if you're thinking about a program.
It's funny. My daughters, who are dancers, very, very avid dancers, they keep on asking, Dad, can you do this? Can you do that? And yesterday they said, Dad, can you do basically handstand push-ups? And you and I are ex-pole vaulters, so we used to do that for training. And so in my brain, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I can do that. No, not yet.
Gotta work out. Well, Jimmy and I share many things in common. One of them was we just found out the last mastermind meeting was the fact that we were both pole vaulters.
Yeah.
I did it my last year as a senior in high school because I realized it was an opportunity that I probably was never going to have again. At least I had the foresight as a young guy, realizing that. And I did it for that season and it was awesome.
Yeah.
But anyways, let's get into some Deal Lab so you can get some good information and some good takeaways. Oh, so I wanted to mention what's going on in the world right now. There was just Investor Magazine came out with stats for their rent collections for May, which everybody was concerned about. And they're actually a little bit higher than April. April was, 86% rents collected. And in May, 87 point something were collected in rents. So rents are holding up in multifamily, which is good. Now, this is based off of, people that use softwares. And somebody said, the small units, 10, 20, 40, typically don't use softwares. They don't, but they typically have a better relationship with their tenants as well. So they usually have a higher rents collected. Now, that percentage is for A and B properties across the board. Typically, your Cs, which are your service workers that are in there, it's about 5% lower. So that's why we always say, B and Bs, B properties and B areas. Cs are great if you're going to upgrade them, if you're going to try to bring them up to a C+, B-. But to be in the, a lot of people start with Cs because they have that mentality. But the sooner you get up to B and Bs, the better you are. So Jimmy, tell everybody your story. Tell everybody how you went from entrepreneur in life to real estate entrepreneur in life.
I'm a Canadian and I'm sitting here right now in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. And we actually can't travel across the border. It's been extended now to June 21st. We're not allowed, and same with the Americans, to come up here, which is something I never dreamt on, that I would have an issue getting across the border to look at properties. But basically, I'm a Canadian, and I've been a business owner and senior executive for over 30 years, was heavily involved in a manufacturing distribution sales organization, and we manufacture a lot of different products. And we built this little company in Canada up to a company that had operations around the world. So we were able to get to travel a lot and meet a lot of neat people and be in a lot of different geographical areas. And along that way, my wife and I also moved to some different markets. And in 1991, we moved to Calgary. And that's when we bought our very first, very small 8-unit multifamily apartment block. I felt there had to be something better there that we could do. And so we actually moved into that. Of course, now you're the owner moving in. And our goal on that was to do a condo conversion. So very difficult because you're trying to transition the property and you're also there as the landlord. So you're very closely connected with everyone.
A good analogy just came to my head. Living in a multifamily property that you own is like having your first child. There's never any peace after that.
It's right? True. Yes. Yeah. And we did the work ourselves. I remember my father-in-law coming out from Winnipeg to help us on weekends. And so we really got kind of the ground floor, how to renovate, and really after that project, no one could pull the wool over our eyes. And we continued doing a few more, but then I refocused back on the manufacturing distribution business. And I really stayed focused on that for a number of years until the meltdown in the US, which happened in 2008-09. And I saw an opportunity. We vacationed in Phoenix, Arizona. When our twins were born, we had to decide where we could go for a holiday. And we kind of said, well, with twins, we probably could withstand up to 3 hours in a plane with them and survive and still be sane. So we drew a circle as to where 3 hours would put us, and Phoenix was the warmest spot that it put us to. So that became the place we went to. And so we were familiar with that market. And so I went down there and started buying up some single family homes, and we created passive income with those single family homes. At the same time, I also found opportunities just to actually flip homes because we're buying them from the courthouse staff short sales. So I had a full-time crew down there renovating, and I could say we'd peel off some of those and effectively built up that to quite a few numbers. And we've subsequently sold off all but four in that marketplace, but we still own them there. And then really I was trying to figure out what next, and I was going to different seminars, and one person, Dave, I know you know well, Marco Rebell, I went to his seminar.
Yeah.
And I was just trying to figure out what next, because as a Canadian, I had to bring my own money with me to finance because there was no financing for foreigners at that time. So I was trying to figure out different systems. And I met these people at his seminar, and they kept talking about you and multifamily and how good it was. And I said, I need to check this out. And so I signed up for on your website, and I started getting the email blasts, the marketing. And then up came a seminar on the micro repositioning. And that was a great weekend, 3-day event that was held in Atlanta. That was in September of 2014. And so I signed up for that and I flew out, and yourself and Jeff were there, and Scott Stafford was at that and presented. And basically it was a very small group of people that we went and we toured Maureen Miles's property. She had just bought one in June, Langley Place, and then Springfield. She had just closed at the end of August, and we were there first week of September. So we were touring her property. Mm-hmm. And then we toured some others, including an A-class property, just to give us a sense. And I was so impressed by it that I signed up for the coaching at that time. And I couldn't start the coaching till February because of my business commitments. But really, that's when I started the coaching. And I wanted to get the coaching for myself because even though I had knowledge of multifamily, it was more based, Canadian based, and I didn't know what I didn't know in the US. So I wanted to make sure I had that expertise helping me. And that basically really helped lay the groundwork. And the other part I found out is that I had no credit in the US. So I couldn't buy a deal even if I wanted to. I remember talking to Ken, and he was saying, so Jim, are you going to live within 100 miles of the property? Are you, all these different criteria? I said, no, no, no. And he says, do you have experience? I said, yes, but in the US, no. So sponsorship became a pretty critical part of this whole mm-hmm. thing to get going. And I also went to the very first sponsorship event, which was fantastic. And so those things really were help be the catalyst to get going on the multifamily, and found a partner in the US because I'm here in Canada. And so partnership, and a lot of this is about partnerships. And so we started going after deals. And I remember Marine Miles, she bought that, I can't remember the exact name of it, but anyway, $25,000 a door in Atlanta. I'm going, what? Like, that's just crazy. And the upside. And so I'm going, we got to check out Atlanta. And so we bought the first deal in Atlanta at $26,800 a door, which is unheard of now. You can't.
How many doors was that?
250 doors, 7.15 million. We paid for that. Right. And so it was south of the airport, south of the 20. And I remember Scott saying, don't go below the 20. No, no, no. Yeah. Bad news. Uh-huh. But it was path of progress because the transit system had been pulled out of that area. Mm. And so for almost 7 years at that point, MARTA wasn't in there and they put it back in. And so all of a sudden now you had the access.
That makes a big difference.
And the property was 3 miles from the airport. So, yeah.
All right. So let's dissect that deal. A lot of people out there want to do their first deal or their first big deal. You had done a couple of smaller deals prior to that. What was the catalyst to getting into the Atlanta market first? I know it was Maureen at 25 a door and you thought, wow, opportunity here. So how did you find that particular deal?
Yeah. So that deal basically was the classic making relationships with brokers. And yeah. I'm a big believer in of actually physically going down, meeting the people, buying them lunch, buying them dinner, building that relationship, finding the commonality with them.
Hold on. Before you can actually set up the meeting, the face-to-face meeting, you have to be doing some dials from home, right?
So yeah, sure. Absolutely.
In that process.
Yeah. So basically I started because I didn't know who, so I was Googling it. So I'm Googling just generally who these people are, and a lot of them aren't coming up on Google that easily. So then basically now you're looking at different websites. And so LoopNet, I went on to LoopNet and I started seeing different agents on there. And that was the ability for me then to start dialing those people, phoning. And then I was usually able to have that conversation with them. And some didn't respond back at all. And quite honestly, it's a hit and miss. And then there was others where you would actually, they would take some time with you and spend the time with you. And I was positioning myself, I'm a Canadian, I'm coming down. Would you happen to know the market, who the leaders are? And so I was asking about brokerage companies, that sort of thing. And some of them were very generous with helping. I also went to a development site, export development. So, but with the agents, then I narrowed it down. I had effectively three agents that I went physically to go meet with. And two of them, I toured some properties. They wanted to show me some stuff, which was good. The other one was just strictly a meet. And I didn't want to push because there was no properties for him to look at. I didn't want to waste the gentleman's time. But that was the start of it. And then basically I went back down a month later and said, oh, I'm coming back down. I just wanted to drive properties. If you have anything of interest, let me know. And they started feeding me some stuff. And I think most people would say, you get garbage at the beginning. They're testing you. So you got to give them feedback. And if you give them feedback as to what you like about it, what you don't like about it, I always would say, hey, do you want me to write an offer on it? Here's where I'd be at. Is that going to insult you? The agents actually wanted me to write an offer because it helped give them strength because they had more offers to show the buyer, their seller. And so it was actually doing them a favor in the sense of here's another person with another range. The other challenge, Dave, is of course, who are you? What's your credibility? Mm-hmm. They're always checking you out on that side. And I leaned a lot on my business experience at the beginning to talk to them about. And then I just talked about my relationship, my team. Kim Taylor to, you know, all the different people. So Kim Taylor being a syndication attorney to our lawyer, to my coach,
who is helping me oversee it. Had you created a relationship with a management company at that time, a local management company?
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely had the management company at that time as well. And they were a big help because they could go tour properties. Art was great about going out and looking at it, giving us his opinion on it if he already didn't know the property. And he was quite knowledgeable already, but he would at a drop of a hat go see the property and say, yeah, no, here's what I like, here's what I don't like, here's the potential I see on it. And so that definitely helped us out tremendously on that side. Yeah. So that's kind of how it progressed. And then once we had the relationships, I kept working at building and meeting more people each time I go down, just so that I know more people. Like, there's the primary brokers and then there's all the smaller brokers that you want to try and touch. And you just never know, because these people sometimes will get different deals that you may not know or be aware of.
How many days did you spend when you went?
Usually three. It just depended. And I know, Dave, you've talked about this, and I was always in the same situation, time crunched. It would literally, from here to get down to Atlanta, would take me almost literally a whole day to get there. Mm-hmm. But I could always get a 6 o'clock flight out and get home at about 1 a.m. if I did it through Minneapolis. So that last day would have to be a bit shorter, but I would spend one travel day and then 2 to 3 days on the ground there. But generally, that's I figured if I'm spending the money to get there, let's make it worthwhile.
Makes sense. Okay, so which broker stepped forward and why with this deal?
Which broker? At that point, that one.
I don't know his name, but did you have a special relationship with him? Was it just a deal that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a couple. I know Vic mentioned the Browns, and I was chuckling because I have a very strong relationship with Barden and Chandler as well. And I think a lot of us do. I know Maureen does as well. But there's some others, ARA out there as well, and CBRE, very strong relationship with the guys there. And so in this one, it was ARA that would have stepped up on it. And quite honestly, it comes down to the commonality. And I'm going to deviate just for a second, because Dave, I remember you mentioning about Harvey McKay. And so I just want to talk about that, because Harvey McKay, Swim with the Sharks book, which I dug it out. I brought it right here. My very first job, I worked as a marketing assistant in an envelope company. And so Winnipeg drive time is about 7.5 hours away from Minneapolis. Harvey McKay owned McKay Envelope in Minneapolis. And one of my tasks the very first year I was marketing assistant was to put together, we belonged to the same association, and they'd have annual awards. And we'd have to, because it was envelope and direct mail, we'd have to put together our best direct mail campaign with the envelope campaign and why that was what it was. And so we were up against McKay envelopes all the time. And so I remember having the opportunity to meet them. And when I actually did meet him, I was just at the end, and my boss, the marketing manager, had been promoted to the sales and marketing manager, and he promoted me to sales rep. And I remember having an opportunity to talk to Harvey for a few minutes, and I said, Harvey, I'm really concerned about selling envelopes, because envelope's an envelope. How do I differentiate? And he says, well, all my people, they build a relationship. They know everything about this, about the people they are. And he says, you know, I'm working on a book right now. He says, I think you'll really enjoy it. He says, but my salespeople, they know the birth dates. They know the wife. They know where they vacation. They know everything about that person. And so I bought the book. And I'll tell you, this book here is a great book, because it was one of those fundamental bases. And if you go through it and you look at this, it's about relationship. And because that relationship is critical in our business, I would suggest to people, they don't realize, by knowing all these things, the commonality you talked about, Dave, I like to know about all those little things. And I make notes on them, because maybe I can't remember, but I acknowledge them. And by doing that, you just have that extra relationship. And that's usually what differentiates yourself from others. And so, as he said, envelopes are envelopes. He says, but your relationship's what's going to make the difference as to why you're going to sell the envelopes.
So he's a great guy, huh?
Yeah, he's a great guy.
All right. So broker's into the deal. Looks like the numbers work, but you're not sure if you're bidding low or what. Did you get any broker price guidance on that deal?
You got the whisper.
Absolutely.
The whisper. Yeah.
So for those of you that aren't familiar with price guidance, that's basically that you've developed your relationship with a broker to the point where he knows what the seller really wants for the property. And then he'll whisper that price to you and tell you in the ballpark. And, you know, certain sellers, they have their MOs, you know, some price 10% higher, some price 15% higher, some price 20% higher. And the brokers get to know that as well. And without even the seller saying, this is my strike price, from past experience, they know what the seller's strike price are. So you get the price guidance. So that's awesome. And then what was the next step?
The fear kicks in. No, just kidding.
It's true. The fear does kick in. I call it, that's a 250 unit property. That's not a small one to start with, you know, the first big deal.
Yeah. And there was some down units in there as well. So now we're going, oh boy. Of course, you've got to do the due diligence right away. The property management company came in. We also hired an engineer to do some inspections for us as well. Just being that it was a 1960, I think that was what, a 60, 1962 or 68, I can't remember, but it was an older property. So we really wanted to be safe on it. And we knew the lender was going to do the inspections as well. So we needed to know before just to get some handle on it. It's an older property. I'm going to say there is no real surprises there other than basically we had to bump up the CapEx a little bit more because there was certain safety requirements. There was, in this particular property, it was two level, sometimes three level. And so they had the steel stairs with the cement slabs in them. And basically some of them were rusting away pretty bad. We had some uneven cement that
we needed. Talk about that, because that's something everybody should be looking for and realizing that if you run into a situation that you're talking about, you're going to have to replace and need to replace the right way. So why don't you just talk a little bit about stairs?
So you can replace, or sometimes they'll let you weld, but if it's rusted, you can't weld rust is basically the premise on that. So you literally are taking out the whole entire section. And then depends though, the pad that it's attaching to, how good is the cement on that? Is there spalling or not? You have to be careful because it can cascade into multiple problems. And so generally though, in our case, we're able to excavate out that piece, crane it out, and put a new piece in, and then they drop in the precast cement stairs into it, and that seemed to satisfy on that. It's not cheap, I'll say. It can add up, and you do need to shop that around.
Yeah. So the situation is when you've got an exterior stair and it is concrete, but it's set inside of a metal casing that is enclosed. What happens is the water gets in, it's got no place to go, and it weathers the concrete, and then you've got to replace. So if you've got that on a property, and the concrete weathers as well, so you got the concrete that's deteriorating, you got the metal is deteriorating as well. So you get the metal deteriorating, you get the concrete deteriorating. And I've seen some people actually replace that with the same, which is a huge mistake. You know, when you see that situation, you got to know that when you do the replacement, you still have the welded metal on the edges, but you don't put the base in at the bottom, you know, that can hold the water. You get it so it can drain out. But once you see that, I mean, that's almost a whole stair replacement, you know, when that starts happening. So it's not an easy fix.
You're right. And especially on older properties, it's amazing. And some of them can be masked as well. But I will say the lender, they inspect them thoroughly, because that's a liability or a potential deferred capital risk. Them, of course, roofs are another one. Structurally too, in this particular case, we had a structural issue with a floor. There was a sub-basement to it, so we had to get that figured out, and we had to apply extra. They wanted extra CapEx. And so with this particular loan, this is our first experience where they wanted all the CapEx held. So we raised the money, but then they held all the CapEx. So Dave, the challenge with that, of course, is if you're not holding any CapEx, how do you get work done when you have no track record? Right. And so now you've got to actually have some extra money so you can actually start the process. Because once you've actually done the work, then you've now got to apply to get that CapEx release back to you to fund in. So it's one of those things that a lot of people maybe don't realize at the beginning, that, oh, well, I've got the CapEx, I'm good. Well, in certain loans, if they hold it, great. The second property we had, they didn't hold it. So we had the money sitting in the bank account. So it was a lot easier.
Yeah, that's a really good point because what he's saying is if you have repairs that need to be done, the bank's holding the CapEx and you've raised it, you still need the money to start the repairs because you're not going to be able to get that CapEx until the next quarter if the repairs are done. And then you got to send them in the invoices.
If you're committing to your investors to pay a preferred rate of return, you're also trying to manage that cash flow coming through as well. So it gets a little tricky at the beginning. And what we learn from that is we do not say that we will pay a preferred rate of return from day one. We did it on this property. We managed to do it, but it killed us to do it. Yeah. So we defer now, and we want at least a couple of quarters to help get things organized. In some cases right now, we're saying a year just to help stabilize everything. It's not that it won't get paid. We will either pay it at the end when we sell, or we accrue it in a separate account and it's held, but we need it just to give us a safety margin for those sort of situations, like if there's CapEx requirements we have to get done and the bank is holding everything or the lender is holding everything.
It's certainly better than a capital call for the investors.
Yes.
I just have to say is in lieu of capital call, and that perks their ears up. All right, so raising the funds. How did that come about? How'd you raise the funds for that deal? $7.1 million deal. What was the raise on that one? About just under $1 million?
It was just over 2.1, I believe, on that. And it was, especially at that time, that's a lot of money to raise. We brought a partner in to help on that, just to back us up, to make sure that we would have enough capital raising on that side, just as a precaution. But basically it was a lot of, had been working at it, and you have to be working at it all the time. You'll hear that a lot. The other thing is that it's true when you come to closing, the people you think like you've, that actually said, yeah, I'm in, a lot of them fall off, and they fall off for various reasons. Maybe they weren't serious. Maybe they couldn't say no to you. Maybe their circumstances have changed, and you really have to plan. I try and go 2.25 times the amount nowadays, just to make sure we've got enough there. And it happened, but we had enough horsepower to raise all the capital. In our case, what it was the lender. We actually had all the capital raised, and we were waiting for the lender to fund it.
What was that last bit you said? Because you kind of went in and out.
The lender. We were waiting for the lender, and the lender was the issue in this particular case. We had all the money sitting there ready to go, and we were continuously waiting for the lender to rate lock. And after another, they kept coming up with new sort of things. Oh, we want to have this inspector go check this out now. And it was just very disorganized. And we found that in this particular lender's case, they had multiple teams working on it and they didn't seem to communicate. And that was our first experience. So we didn't really know if that was the norm or not. And subsequently, we found out that's not the norm. It just happened to be that particular lender was very disorganized.
So let's go back to the money. So the raising of the money, you said you had a third party come in to help with the raise?
Well, we brought another person into our team, basically. And this person was part of the management. So not just raising the capital, but also became part of our team. So I had a partner in the U.S. Originally, Steve, and then myself. And then we brought another lady in, Eileen, as well, who is a fellow Canadian, actually. And so the three of us did that deal together.
So just to give the folks that are watching an indication of, you know, how you were able to do the raise, what was their strategy for raising money? And what was your own strategy for raising money? Did you raise any of that money yourself?
Yeah.
Okay. How did you do it?
You start with the friends and family, which in my case didn't work out so well. So they all just didn't see it at that time.
They didn't see the vision.
Nope. They didn't see me with that vision, that's for sure, in that position. So then I had to peel back the onion further. And I went to professional people I knew, so accountant, lawyer, financial advisor, and talked to those people who introduced me to other people that were more in sync. And at the beginning, quite honestly, Dave, I was getting worried that I had lost my touch in how I was presenting. Was I saying something wrong? I was trying to analyze what am I doing? I'm not asking for money. I'm presenting an opportunity. And it was such a relief when I finally hit that first person who was introduced to me by my financial advisor, and they got it and they were all in. It was just like, yeah, sure, that's good. And that validation was huge and built the confidence to continue on. And so basically I kept working at, call it, other professionals. And so meeting those people basically through connections. And so I would just always ask, do you know anyone else who might have interest in something like this? And that usually like, yeah, you know, actually I do. And it just kind of kept spawning from there. And also I've talked about the fact I fly a lot. So typically on a plane, you've got that window when you first sit down of a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes works out really well, where you can basically exchange, oh, what's the reason for your travel or whatever? Oh, I'm on a business trip. Oh, what type of business is that? Which gives an opening. And so if they express interest at that point, oh yeah, hey, I'm a real estate, I love real estate. Oh, and then you can kind of go from there. If not, then you leave it alone and you put your headset on and have a nice flight. But generally I found good success there. And restaurants too. I usually sit at the bar in a higher end hotel restaurant. And so there's some other business guys sitting there usually. And sometimes you can, if the game's on or different things, you'll strike up a conversation like that. And it's just funny how that goes. And so there's all these different ways of hitting it. And so I used all of that in that deal to try and get people that would be interested in it. And that was the start. And once you've done a deal, it really helps you because you've got momentum. And then the referral, it starts building momentum from there.
Absolutely. Your private money people become your salespeople.
Yeah, it's true.
Friends,
it's
and true. So on.
Good. Exciting.
Stuff. All right. So listen, we're at the top of the hour. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your expertise. How about, you know, the people that are asking questions are mastermind and mentorship students. So what advice would you give them going into the next round of buying?
I honestly think laser focus. Like, you've got to have your goals set up and you've got to be laser focused. And to what you just mentioned earlier, fill in the gaps now, guys, because you won't have time to fill in the gaps after. So shore up, whether it's education, relationships, in terms of making sure you've got your potential capital side ready to go. Because when it goes, you want to be like a well-oiled machine. So you've got to make sure you've got your teams in place and everything in place. So this is the time to basically do a SWOT analysis and make sure you've got your strengths, weaknesses, the threats, all handled. And if you've got all that handled, you're going to be in good position to hit the pavement running hard. So, and you've got to have your focus goal. Don't let fear, just laser focus. I've always had a point and I let all the noise goes right by me. I'm focused on it.
And don't get an itchy trigger finger.
Yeah. Yeah. True.
The opportunities when they come, it's like right now, it's just a downtime, you know, so sharpen your skills, you know, get yourself ready, but just know that it's okay to be placid at this particular point, you know, to be focused on, you know, maybe reading some books or doing some other stuff, because when it starts, it's going to start and it's going to be fast and furious for a 2 or 3 year period. It's going to be great. So yeah. Enjoy the downtime now, get yourself ready, and then let's go.
Let's go hard.
All right. I want to thank everybody for being on Deal Lab, and I will see you all next week. And we'll do it again with another special guest. We'll dissect another deal, and we'll see everybody. We'll see everybody next week. Same time, same channel. Bye, everybody.
Bye, Jim.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Multifamily Deal Lab podcast, where the deals get done. If you'd like to learn more, visit davesfreebook.com. And don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review and hit that subscribe button so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening.